Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 112.
I want to set the scene for you really quick because the physical geography and the timing here are just absolutely crucial to understand.
Yeah, context is everything here.
Right, so the Gia family is massive, but right now they're completely fragmented. The matriarch, who's just called the old lady, has recently died.
And that death creates a huge vacuum.
A massive vacuum. The patriarch, Jia Zhang, and his nephew, Jia Lian, basically all the male authority figures, they've physically left the main estate.
They're camped out at this place called the Iron Threshold Temple.
Right. They're managing these incredibly elaborate extended funeral rites,
which structurally just hollows out the entire main compound.
Completely.
The traditional protectors and, you know, the decision makers, they're miles away. Mm-hmm. They're totally distracted by the performance of grief and the logistics of this monumental aristocratic funeral.
So who is left in charge of the sprawling home estate?
It's nominally under the control of Jifeng, who's also called Fengji, which is currently bedridden.
Like severely ill, right?
Yeah, she's very sick. And alongside her is a young, sheltered, unmarried woman named Shi Chun.
And it's under this specific, really fragile watch that this massive robbery takes place.
Yeah.
But the detail that really is that this wasn't an external siege.
No, it was an inside job.
They were let in. And the way the characters react to this internal betrayal, I mean, it just reveals the fatal disease right at the heart of their society.
It really exposes everything. Let's jump straight into the immediate aftermath of the break-in, because the estate is just in total chaos.
The thieves have fled, and Fengji, despite being incredibly sick, she tries to implement, like, standard crisis management.
Right. She orders the Night Watch women to be tied up and interrogated.
Which makes sense. Her instinct is to reassert dominance, you know, punish the lowest visible rung of the hierarchy.
But the friction here is just fascinating, because two male servants, Lin Zixiao and Jia Yin, they actually intervene and actively prevent her from executing this order.
Wait, really? Why? Are they trying to protect the watchwomen?
Not at all. They don't do this out of mercy. They do it because of the intricate, toxic patronage system that basically holds the whole family together.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. They inform Fengji that the thieves were aided by an insider. Specifically, the godson of a servant named Zhu Rui.
Okay, I am genuinely stuck on the mechanics of this household hierarchy.
It's confusing, yeah.
Because, I mean, if I run a company, right, and a security guard leaves the back door open for criminals to rob the warehouse.
You'd fire the guard.
I fire the guard. I call the authorities. Why can't Fengji, who is effectively the CEO of this estate, just punish the people responsible? Why does the name Zhu Rui suddenly paralyze everything?
Because, well, you're looking at it through a modern meritocratic lens.
Oh, where employment is just transactional.
Exactly. In the Gia household, power flows through this feudal web of patronage and proximity, not merit.
Proximity to the top.
Right. Zhu Rui isn't just some contractor. He is deeply, intimately connected to the madam of the house.
Who is, like, the matriarchal figure just below the deceased old lady.
Exactly. So to punish Zhu Rui's godson means putting Zhu Rui himself on trial.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah, and putting Zhu Rui on trial inevitably means examining the madam's judgment, her inner circle, her management of her own people.
Wow. So Lin Zixiai and Jia Yun are basically warning Fengji that pulling this one single thread will just unravel the entire aristocratic facade.
They explicitly warn her. They say, you know, if they dig into this from the madam on down, inside and out, no one is clean.
So enforcing the law is actually more dangerous to the survival of the institution than the crime itself.
That is exactly the trap they're in.
That is wild. And Fengji's reaction here is a radical departure from her usual characterization, isn't it?
Oh, completely. Everything else in the broader context paints her as this fiercely capable, even ruthless manager.
But here she's literally gasping for breath on her sickbed and she just surrenders.
Yeah.
She tells them to simply report the stolen items and let the men deal with it later. And she mutters this line. She says, "This is all brought on by fate."
She completely abdicates her authority.
Hmm.
It is the moment the illusion of control just shatters for her.
Brought on by fate. That is such a heavy line.
Well, fatalism is often the last refuge of a manager who realizes the system they manage is fundamentally unmanageable.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
But you have to contrast Fengji's administrative paralysis with the deeply personal psychological paralysis of the younger woman, Xin Chun.
Right, Xin Chun. Her reaction is arguably even more disturbing, honestly, because of where she directs her terror.
Yeah, she was just in a compound that was violently invaded. Priceless ancestral wealth was looted.
But she isn't mourning the stolen heirlooms.
No.
And she isn't trembling about the physical danger she narrowly avoided either. Her internal monologue is just entirely consumed by the concept of shame.
Yeah. She weeps, asking how she is going to see anyone tomorrow when the masters return.
She says, "Where am I to put my face now?"
And the concept of face in this text, it really cannot be dismissed as just mere vanity or social anxiety.
What does it mean for her practically?
For an unmarried aristocratic woman like Xinxin, face is her entire socioeconomic currency. It's her physical safety, her marriage prospects, her literal right to exist within the family structure.
Because the robbery occurred under her nominal watch?
Exactly. It does not matter that she lacked the physical strength or the political authority to actually stop an armed inside job heist.
The system doesn't care.
Right. In a rotting institution, the hierarchy always demands a scapegoat, and blame reliably flows downward to the most vulnerable.
It feels like she has just absorbed the structural failure of the family and internalized it as a personal moral failing.
That's precisely what's happening.
But I want to challenge her perspective a bit here. Why doesn't she direct her anger outward?
What do you mean?
Like, why isn't she furious at the corrupt servants who sold her out or the thieves who terrorized her? Why blame herself?
Well, that requires an expectation of justice, which Xinxin clearly lacks. She understands, maybe subconsciously, that the system does not prioritize fairness. It prioritizes appearances.
So getting angry at the thieves won't restore her social standing.
Right. Her anger turns inward because society has trained her to view herself merely as an extension of the family's reputation. When that reputation is violated, she feels personally ruined.
That is just tragic. And while Xinxin and Fengji are trapped in this, like, introspective paralysis, agonizing over internal politics and lost face, the text does something really dramatic.
It pulls our focus right to the perimeter of the estate.
Exactly. The actual physical threat hasn't vanished at all. The thieves are still out there, hiding in the shadows.
And the narrative gives us this remarkable window into the perpetrator's perspective, which just shifts the power dynamic entirely.
Let's talk about the thieves. The crew is led by a man named Hisan, and they're in a state of high anxiety.
Yeah, because during their escape, one of the family's remaining loyal defenders, a man named Bao Yang, actually managed to chase them down.
And he killed Hisan.
Right. So the remaining thieves are huddled together, realizing they have just escalated from simple burglary to a situation involving murder.
Their immediate pragmatic plan makes sense, though. They want to flee to the ocean and reinvent themselves as pirates.
Yeah, to avoid state execution.
Yeah.
Fleeing to the ocean is like a classic survival mechanism for outlaws in this era.
It means abandoning the rigid mainland society, right?
Exactly. Trading it for the lawless frontier of the sea. It shows they understand the severe consequences and are acting purely on preservation.
But then, and this is the part that just blew my mind, the text throws us a massive curveball.
One of the thieves completely derails the survival plan.
Yes. While they were looting the compound earlier, he happened to glance through a window, and he saw two women sitting under a lamp. Xinxin and this beautiful nun named Miao Yu,
who resides in the family's Green Bower Hermitage.
Right. And this thief becomes intensely obsessed with Miao Yu. But what shocked me wasn't just the obsession. It was the fact that he actually recognizes her.
And the mechanism of that recognition, it completely upends our understanding of the Jia family's security.
How so?
Well, the estate's walls are incredibly high, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're designed to keep the dirty, chaotic world out. Yet this common thief looks through a window and immediately identifies the secluded nun based on street gossip.
He literally recalls rumors circulating in the town. He thinks to himself, you know, isn't she the one who had a secret romantic connection with the Jia family's second master, Bao Yu?
The one who got lovesick and had doctors rushing in and
out. Yes. Think about the implications of that for a second. The family's most private, deeply guarded scandals, the emotional fragility of a ward, the secret crushes, the comings and goings of private physicians.
It's all out there.
It's been digested by the public, and it's now being casually recounted by a murderer in an alleyway.
It acts as a sort of reverse panopticon.
Oh, I like that. Explain that a bit.
Well, the wealthy elites believe they are isolated and secure in their high towers looking down on the world. But in reality, the masses have been watching them the entire time.
Cataloging their weaknesses.
Right, their desires, their hypocrisies. The physical breach of the robbery was only possible because the psychological and informational walls of the estate had crumbled years ago.
That is brilliant. And the audacity of this thief's decision to act on it is just staggering.
They are wanted for murder.
Right. The logical move is to run for the coast, Instead, he decides to risk capture, torture, and a brutal execution simply to go back inside and kidnap this nun.
It completely strips away any lingering aura of intimidation the Gia family might have held.
Because they're just not scared of them anymore.
Exactly. The text explicitly details the criminal's assessment of the family's strength. As they fled, they noted that, except for Bao Yang, the guy who killed their leader, the rest of the estate's defenders were quote-unquote useless people.
Useless people. Ouch.
The thieves have accurately diagnosed the class rot. The aristocratic family is wealthy, yes, but they are morally compromised, politically paralyzed, and physically soft.
They've lost their teeth.
Precisely. The criminals no longer fear the institution. They just view it as a buffet.
Wow. So while this predator is plotting his return, deciding which window he's going to pry open, the family members at the estate are completely oblivious.
Yeah, their attention is elsewhere.
They are sending messengers to the Iron Threshold Temple to inform the patriarchs. So let's look at how the men, the ultimate authorities of this world, handle the crisis.
The transition from the physical terror at the estate to the bureaucratic panic at the temple is, well, it highlights the deep absurdity of their priorities.
It really does. So the servant, Jia Yun, finally arrives at the temple breathless. He delivers the news of the massive home invasion to the patriarch, Jia Zhang, and his nephew, Jia Lin.
And Jia Lin's immediate reaction is just explosive physical violence.
He straight up attacks Jia Yun. He berates him, spits in his face, furiously blaming him for failing his night watch duties.
Which is a textbook example of displaced aggression.
Right, because he can't fix the real problem.
Exactly. He's a man who knows the structural integrity of his family is failing, but he lacks the capacity or the courage to fix the systemic issues.
Like the internal corruption of Zururui.
Right. So he exerts maximum brutal force on the lowest available target. It's the performance of authority without any of the actual substance.
But I want to focus on Jia Zhang, the overarching patriarch, because his reaction absolutely baffled me.
How so?
Well, his ancestral home has just been invaded by armed men. The women under his protection have been traumatized.
Yeah.
But his response isn't to mount a rescue mission or to reinforce the perimeter. His primary overwhelming concern is paperwork.
Paperwork.
Yes. He is terrified of how to report the stolen items to the local magistrates.
I'd push you to consider the political reality of Jia Zhang's position here, though.
Okay, why?
You're viewing the government authorities as allies or protectors in a time of crisis. In Jia Zhang's world, the state is a predator just waiting for an aristocracy to show weakness.
Unpack that for me. Why would a police report be dangerous to the victim of a robbery?
Because of what was actually stolen. The looted wealth belonged to the recently deceased old lady. And aristocratic families of this era often hoarded massive amounts of unregistered gold, silver, and precious artifacts.
Wait, to avoid taxation?
Yes, to avoid taxation and to maintain a secret political war chest.
Oh, wow.
Jia Zhang explicitly tells Jia Lian that if they list the actual high-value items that were stolen, the magistrates will immediately ask, where did you get all this undocumented wealth?
Oh. So it exposes the family to accusations of hoarding and corruption.
Potentially even treason.
So it's a massive double bind. He can't tell the truth because the truth exposes their financial crimes.
But he also warns against lying.
Right. He says if they just make up random numbers of missing silver and the magistrates catch them in a lie on an official state document, the family could be politically ruined for perjury.
Precisely. The external crisis, the robbery, has acted as this brutal X-ray, forcing them to look at the hidden rot in their own accounting.
The stolen wealth represented the last hidden safety net of their former glory.
And now, it's not only gone, but the very act of losing it has become a profound political liability.
And the text highlights this bureaucratic nightmare with a detail of pure dark comedy back at the main house.
Oh, with Amber.
Yes. A servant named Amber is tasked with actually drafting this required inventory list. But the room has been entirely ransacked. Chests are smashed open. Items are scattered everywhere.
And no one has any idea what was actually in those boxes to begin with.
Exactly. Amber sits there crying and literally invents a fake inventory list from memory. She's just guessing at numbers and items. And that fiction is what they prepare to send to the government.
It perfectly encapsulates the unmoored reality the Gia family now inhabits.
Yeah.
Objective truth no longer exists within their walls.
They're just substituting a fictional performance of order to appease a terrifying authority.
desperately trying to cover up a chaotic reality they've completely lost the ability to control.
It's insane. And while the men at the temple agonize over the political optics of their fictional paperwork, the very real physical consequences of their defenseless estate are playing out in the dark.
Let's return to the Greenbauer Hermitage and the nun, Miao Yu.
This abduction sequence, it is written with a chilling clinical precision. It's honestly one of the most horrifying moments in the entire text.
It really is.
It's 4.00 a.m. The estate is theoretically on high alert after the robbery, but in reality, everyone is exhausted and just hiding. Miao Yu is entirely alone.
She's already deeply unsettled, shivering in the cold, trying to center herself in meditation beneath this single sea lamp.
And then the obsessed thief arrives at her window.
But he doesn't smash the glass.
No, he doesn't kick the door down. He utilizes a much more insidious method, one that fundamentally violates her bodily autonomy before he even enters the room.
He uses a tool called sleeping incense.
Right. And the text provides these incredibly visceral, sensory details here. Miao Yu smells a strange, sweet fragrance drift through the paper window and enter her head.
And almost instantly, her entire physical form betrays her.
Her body goes completely numb. She loses control of her arms and legs. She tries to scream to call for her fellow nuns, but her jaw is just slack.
She is physically paralyzed, yet her mind remains entirely conscious and aware.
That is just nightmare fuel.
It is. And the mechanics of the sleeping incense, they operate as this devastating metaphor for the condition of women in this society.
How so?
Well, Miao Yu is repeatedly characterized throughout the broader narrative as an extremely clean and pure daughter. She is an ascetic.
Right. She's dedicated her life to spiritual elevation.
Exactly. Aggressively distancing herself from the dirty physical realities of the secular world. But the incense violently reduces her from a spiritual being into a helpless physical object.
She is trapped inside her own paralyzed flesh.
Forced to act as a silent, conscious spectator to her own defilement.
Ugh, that's so dark. The thief slips into the room. He sees that the incense has worked, and he mocks her helplessness, aggressively embracing her while she cannot resist.
The text describes her feeling foolish and drunk in her paralyzed state as he simply picks her up and carries her out the window.
But the detail that truly haunts me, the piece of the text I just keep turning over in my mind, is his escape route.
Yeah, how he gets out.
He carries her down a ladder, places her in a cart, and approaches the main city gates. How does he get out of the heavily guarded city with a kidnapped woman?
He employs the ultimate tool of aristocratic privilege.
He lights an official aristocratic lantern.
Right.
He doesn't slink through the shadows or, like, bribe the guards. He hangs a stolen emblem of state power on his cart and just casually rolls up to the front gates.
And the city guards see the lantern, assume it is official noble business, and respectfully wave him through.
Consider the devastating irony here. Jia Zhang is currently miles away at the temple, sweating in terror over how to properly interact with the state authorities.
Obsessed with maintaining the appearance of noble compliance.
Yes. Meanwhile, a murderer is utilizing the very symbols of that noble authority to casually bypass state security and facilitate a horrific crime.
The system's tools are perfectly functional. They just have no allegiance.
Anyone holding the lantern wields the power.
Exactly. The authority of the aristocracy has been completely hollowed out. It's just a prop now.
And the text makes a very deliberate, brutal choice regarding the aftermath, doesn't it?
It does. The narrator steps in and explicitly refuses to provide closure.
We are told it is unknown whether Miao Yu submitted to the thief's insults and lived, or if she died unyielding. She simply vanishes into the lawless world beyond the gates.
The ambiguity forces the reader and the characters left behind to just sit with the agonizing lack of resolution.
And that lack of resolution crashes down on the remaining characters when the sun rises. The morning after the abduction is just. It's a portrait of an institution turning on its own.
Because Miao Yu's fellow nuns and servants wake up, right?
Right. They find the ladder left against the wall, discover a dropped sword sheath, and realize with mounting dread what has occurred, they run to the main family for help.
And the first person they encounter is Bao Yang, the guard who chased the thieves the night before.
And Bao Yang's response provides this stark look at the absolute absence of empathy within the family's ecosystem.
It's really hard to read.
The nuns are begging for a search party, and Bao Yang sneers at them. He accuses Miao Yu of willingly eloping with the criminals.
He says, "Your master led the thieves in. She's gone off with them to enjoy herself."
The cruelty is staggering. A woman is drugged and violently abducted from her bed, and the immediate reflex at the estate's security is to accuse her of orchestrating it for sexual thrill.
Well, victim blaming is a highly effective defense mechanism for a failed protector.
Oh, because if she chose to leave...
Then Bao Yang didn't fail the protector, and the walls of the estate didn't fail. The institution preserves its ego by sacrificing the reputation of the victim.
That makes awful sense. And Shi Chun, the young woman who spent the previous night paralyzed by shame, overhears this exchange.
Seeing the guard casually destroy Miao Yu's reputation breaks something fundamental inside Shi Chun.
She realizes that the family will not protect anyone.
The text gives us access to Shi Chun's internal monologue here, and it operates as a grim, devastating roll call of the family's women. It's a systemic audit of aristocratic womanhood.
She mentally lists the fates of her female relatives. She thinks of Ying Chun, who was married off to a cruel man and literally tortured to death.
She thinks of sister Shi, burdened with a tragically ill husband.
She thinks of third sister, who was sent thousands of miles away into political exile.
She looks at the men failing to govern. She listens to the servants blaming a kidnapped nun.
And she realizes her noble birth, her status as a daughter of a great house, isn't a shield at all. It is a cage.
She recognizes the illusion of her society. She thought playing by the rules, maintaining her face, and staying inside the walls would guarantee her safety.
But the events of the last 24 hours have proven that the rules are rigged, the face is worthless, and the walls are porous.
So in a moment of sheer desperation, she grabs a pair of scissors and violently cuts off half of her hair.
She attempts to renounce the world and become a nun right there on the spot. Her servants have to physically tackle her and wrestle the scissors away to stop her.
I want to look closely at the irony of her action here. What is the specific mechanism of her proposed escape?
It's incredibly dark, right? Because Shi Chun's immediate frantic response to watching her friend, a nun, get violently kidnapped from a hermitage is to try and become a nun herself.
It makes no logical sense.
None. She just watched the spiritual sanctuary fail to provide physical protection, yet she tries to dive headfirst into it.
It highlights the absolute poverty of options available to her. She cannot flee to the ocean like the thieves. She cannot wield authority like the men.
She believes that if she can sever her ties to the physical world will stop hurting her.
She actually thinks to herself that Miao Yu was like a free cloud and wild crane. She romanticizes the nun's life.
But she completely ignores the reality that the free cloud was just paralyzed with drugs and thrown into the back of a smuggler's cart.
There's no escape. The physical decay of this world is absolute.
But the narrative doesn't allow us to remain in the purely physical political realm, does it?
No, it takes a wild turn here.
Just as Shi Chun attempts to sever her spiritual ties to a rotting world, the text violently yanks us back to the Iron Threshold Temple, revealing that the rot is not just political, it is metaphysical.
This is a major tonal shift.
It really is. This is the moment in the source material where I literally had to stop and reread the page because the genre shifts so abruptly it causes whiplash.
From true crime to supernatural horror.
Exactly. We go from a gritty home invasion and kidnapping narrative straight into an exorcist-style supernatural sequence. I really struggled with this pivot. Why introduce ghosts and demons right when the political tension is at its peak?
Because in the philosophical framework of this literature, the physical, the political, and the spiritual are deeply inextricably linked.
Okay, so they mirror each other.
Right. A society cannot experience this level of material corruption and moral bankruptcy without triggering a karmic reckoning. The physical breach of the robbery has basically ruptured the spiritual seal of the family.
Let's walk through exactly what happens so you all can picture it. The family is at the temple, finally packing up their carriages to return to the city and deal with the fallout of the heist.
And suddenly, a woman named Zhao Yinyang, a concubine within the family structure, collapses onto the stone floor.
She begins foaming at the mouth. Her eyes roll back into her head. When she speaks, her voice is distorted, seemingly speaking in multiple voices at once.
She is entirely possessed.
And the entities possessing her force her to articulate the hidden, poisonous history of the family. The secrets that couldn't be discussed in the polite society of the estate are just screamed out loud on the temple floor.
Through this possessed state, she confesses to horrific crimes.
She admits that years ago she hired a sorceress named Ma Daopo to use black magic to try and assassinate Fenji and the young heir, Bao Yu.
She is writhing on the ground, screaming in terror, claiming that the King of Hell has sent emissaries to drag her to the underworld.
She even points at empty air, shrieking that the ghost of a deceased servant, Yuan Yang, is standing right in front of her, demanding payment for past cruelties.
The supernatural elements here serve to make the abstract concept of consequence brutally literal.
Like the audit.
Yes, exactly. Jia Zhang was terrified of the government magistrates auditing his hidden wealth. Zhao Yinyang is facing an audit of her hidden sins by a cosmic magistrate.
The text is suggesting that the family's obsession with hiding their dirty laundry behind high walls and polite manners is ultimately futile.
The buried sins will literally claw their way out of the floorboards.
But look at how the family reacts to this horrifying display of divine or demonic justice. Zhao Yinyang is on the ground begging the family members, specifically second granny, Feng Ji, for forgiveness.
She is experiencing an agonizing, terrifying death right in front of them.
And what does the Madam Wang Furin do?
She recoils in disgust and expedites their departure.
Exactly. They basically say, well, this is unpleasant. Let's go. They leave a dying, possessed woman behind at the temple with a couple of low-level caretakers, jump into their carriages, and flee back to the city.
The sheer emotional bankruptcy is staggering.
They treat a supernatural reckoning, a literal manifestation of their family's buried evil, as nothing more than a minor, distasteful inconvenience to just walk away from.
It proves they are incapable of spiritual reflection. They are fleeing the physical threats back at the estate, and they are fleeing the supernatural threats at the temple.
They are a family entirely defined by running away from the consequences of their own structure.
Which brings us to the final act. The patriarch, Jia Zhang, finally returns from the temple to face the music at the main estate.
And what he finds is an institution that has entirely collapsed in his absence.
Jia Zhang steps out of his carriage and immediately tries to play the role of the commanding master.
He summons the servant Lin Zixiao. He demands a full report. He demands that Zhu Rui be immediately bound, arrested, and hauled off to the magistrate for brutal punishment. He wants a public display of his authority to reestablish the hierarchy.
He is treating a terminal disease with a band-aid.
Completely.
He believes that by surgically removing one bad actor, Zhu Rui, the integrity of the estate will be magically restored. He fails to grasp that Zhu Rui is a product of the system Jia Zhang himself oversees.
And Jilian, the nephew, is the one who finally forces the patriarch to look at the terminal diagnosis.
While Jia Zhang is shouting orders, Jilian pulls him aside and delivers a series of devastating blows.
First, he tells him Feng Ji is deathly ill, meaning the administrative engine of the house is broken. But then he delivers the fatal strike.
The family is functionally bankrupt.
The financial reality finally breaches the noble facade. Jilian explains that the robbery didn't just hurt them, it ruined them. The hidden reserves are gone.
And they are currently in the middle of this massive performative funeral for the old lady.
And Jilian admits they do not have the liquid cash to pay for the rest of it. The great aristocratic Jia family cannot afford to bury their own matriarch.
Examine the solution Jilian proposes here, because it perfectly illustrates the parasitic nature of the institution.
Jilian quietly suggests that they might have to force the servants of the household to pay out of their own pockets to cover the master's funeral expenses.
He wants to tax the bottom to subsidize the pride of the top.
And Jia Zing's reaction to this is incredibly telling. He angrily rejects the idea, asking, "Are you telling me that because the family silver was stolen, we should penalize the servants?"
He wants to maintain his self-image as a righteous, benevolent lord.
Right. He refuses the parasitic solution, but he offers absolutely no alternative. He has run out of moves.
And Jialian has this quiet moment of realization that serves as the thesis for the entire narrative. He says, "I didn't expect the family's luck to decline to this extent."
He finally verbalizes that the robbery wasn't the cause of their ruin. It was simply a stress test.
And the structure failed the test spectacularly.
The decay had been hollowing out the family for years through corruption, infighting, financial mismanagement, and moral cruelty.
All of this was obscured by the massive physical walls, the official lanterns, and the polite societal face.
The thieves merely kicked in a door that was already entirely rotted through.
Which leaves us with the final haunting image of this section of the text. Jia Zhang, the master of the house, the ultimate patriarchal authority figure, dismisses everyone.
He doesn't give a grand speech to rally the family. He doesn't draw a sword.
No. He walks alone into his study. He sits down heavily on the floor, and he simply sighs.